it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate, and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Hi, this is Peter Gellerus,
author of Anarchy Works, Worshiping Power, How Nonviolence Protects the State, and many other classics. Once again, back on It's Going Down podcast. Thanks for joining us, Peter. Always great to have you on. We're going to be talking about the situation as we enter a new era, supposedly, with Biden coming into office. There's a lot to talk about, everything from the storming of the Capitol to the coronavirus pandemic, which now has hit the grisly mark, at least in the so-called United States, of 400,000 deaths. And we're going to be talking about a lot of stuff today, and we're glad to have you on. But just to dive into it, I want to get your initial thoughts just as we enter the Biden era. You know, is this a new turning, as the center and part of the left would have us believe, or at least a step forward? Or is this just going to be a continuation in a lot of ways? Or is it going to be a mix?
I think it's going to be a mix. I mean, on the one hand, you know, it can certainly be relieving that, you know, we won't have to see Trump's god-awful face in the media quite so often. And, you know, that's understandable. But yeah, it's important to also recognize the dangers of this moment. I think certainly we will see changes in a lot of the strategies that the state is using, different possibilities for capitalism to deal with its ongoing crisis. And then we'll see plenty of aspects of continuation. These could easily be famous last words. We might see a little bit less weirdness than you know, we were kind of getting used to during the Trump era. But in the end, I wouldn't be at all surprised if 2021 were able to surprise us. But I think you will see a bit of a return to more standard modes of governance from Biden, which, of course, you know, being the president of the United States, that obviously doesn't bode well for people in the U.S., for the rest of the world. I mean, you know, there's definitely going to be a resurgence of U.S. imperialism, for example.
In some ways, was Trump a better opponent for social movements, just that he represented something so bad, but yet at the same time, just organizationally, he was just so inept in a lot of ways?
I don't think we should think about it like that, if only because we don't get to choose our opponents. We have to deal with the system as it is, as you know, as we find it. But yeah, Trump was not a very intelligent person. He definitely put a whole lot of effort and enthusiasm into using the instruments of government to push a far right agenda, sort of as quickly as possible, but without putting really hardly any intelligent thought into how to create a transformation like that in the long term, and how to build power for a more far right agenda from the state in the long term. So he ultimately very clearly sabotaged himself. And so, you know, whereas his executive actions, you know, for example, among other things, caused a great deal of harm. He has placed the institutional right in the U.S. in something of a crisis, and he was often his own worst enemy. So that's certainly true. So, you know, one of the things that we have to be afraid of now, not afraid, one of the things we have to be concerned about now and conscious of now is the power of a more intelligent and a more unified government that's not working at cross purposes with itself so much.
Do you think there will also be an effect under Biden where a lot of people may have put some hope into him that things will change, but there will be sort of a reaction in a sense when things basically stay the same as there was under Obama? I mean, towards the end of Obama's term, we saw an explosion of stuff in the streets, whether it's Standing Rock or the prison strike or, you know, obviously everything that happened in Ferguson and Baltimore. Do you think there'll be a similar thing under Biden, or people are pretty aware of what they've got right now to begin with?
I think it's a mix. I think there's a lot of people who are aware, a lot of people who have very much bought into this dream. I think some people will become disappointed with Biden's inadequacies as regards, like, you know, people's actual needs, like, you know, working class people on the ground. There's a lot of people who will definitely become disappointed fairly soon, and there's other people who, I think it depends a lot on you know, the kind of outreach we do, the kinds of disruption that we're able to cause, the extent to which we're able to direct attention at things that certainly aren't going away, like the border regime and you know, the immigrant detention centers, the bloated, completely monstrous prison system, pipeline projects, all of the, you know, the green capitalist initiatives that are coming down the pipe. So a lot of it is up to anarchists and other anti-capitalists and how well we spread the word about, you know, about these different things. 'Cause, you know, I mean, in terms of people's own experiences, when people are getting evicted from their own houses, obviously they're going to notice, if people in their neighborhoods are getting killed by the cops, obviously they're going to notice. But, you know, there's also the question of, what about the people in the next neighborhood over? What about people living in the cities, not being aware of what's happening, with pipelines in the countryside, or people who have, you know, who are a tiny bit higher up in the pecking order, say people who have the privilege of citizenship, perhaps not being aware of, you know, what's going on to people without papers. And so that's something that, you know, that we need to get out there as effectively as we can.
So Biden is entering the office inheriting a pandemic that's now killed upwards of 400,000 people just in the United States. And we're also still in a very potentially volatile economic situation. I just want to get your thoughts on that.
That's been Biden's number one focus today with the executive actions that the executive orders that he's pushing through. He's coming in broadcasting a message really to the world that this is going to be his priority, that he's going to turn this around. A large part of the reason for that is on an international stage. I mean, the U.S. has been the big loser with the COVID pandemic. And, you know, it is really absurd and immature to think about it like this. But, you know, states they're constantly thinking about their brand, especially the state that fashions itself as the world leader. So being the absolute worst in something was not a good look. And Biden has also from the beginning been sending signals to Europe, to the World Health Organization, and so on, with this message that America's back. So it really is, you know, a more effective Make America Great campaign or branding strategy than the one that Trump was able to roll out. So a large part of it is actually about trying to recover this absurd and very, very harmful idea of the U.S. being, you know, the greatest country in the world, and all the rest. So to do that, I mean, you know, they're obviously not going to be able to compete with, other countries that have much better stats on the pandemic. But at the very least, they have to make sure that the U.S. is not, you know, the world leader in deaths and infections. And again, a large part of that is just for the look. A large part of that is just to be able to reclaim this imperialist mantle of world leader. Cause we have to remember that all of the liberals and progressives out there are just absolutely just indignant. And these extremely racist things were just oozing out of their mouths, like, all, you know, from, you know, CNN to the Washington Post to the New York Times, how, like, on January 6th, they were just constantly saying, you know, that this is the type of thing that, you know, we're used to seeing in Iraq or, you know, some African country. And, you know, to see, like, you know, an election contested with violence in the United States is just terrible. So they were basically saying the same racist things that Trump was saying, but just with more polite language. And so, I mean, they're so indignant. They really want to improve their brand. Of course, the U.S. health system is quite a disaster. So there's really only going to be so much that they can do. I mean, obviously, they will be able to turn around certain trends. They will be able to decrease death rates and infection rates, speed up vaccinations. I don't think it will be such a dramatic change for people on the ground, for poor people, for racialized people, for anyone without good health coverage. Because, I mean, with the kind of like privatized infrastructure that they have, there's only so much that they can do. But it will be a pretty big change in terms of the U.S. image, both, you know, and again, that will also make a big difference with like middle class people in the U.S. Who have better health coverage, who live in healthier conditions, who can, you know, afford to work from home or not go into work all the time. They will probably begin to get a much more inaccurate view of how bad the situation is on the ground. Probably pretty quickly, they'll start to think that things are a lot better than they actually are. So that's, you know, an important point of intervention. You know, not saying that our strategy is to prioritize what more middle class people are thinking, but definitely to intervene in ways that creates support, that creates resources for people most affected by the pandemic, and also that basically that makes it so that those deaths and that suffering can't be swept under the rug. As for the recession, Wall Street has received Biden's election pretty optimistically. Growth forecasts for the U.S. economy are growing. I'm going to want to do like more in-depth research to look at, you know, like the midterm prospects for that. Like right now, I'm not going to say with any confidence if I think, you know, there will be another crash or another recession in the next 2 years or so. It's certainly possible that, that this year in general, we'll see economic growth, but, you know, that usually takes a long time to trickle down. So there's again going to be a whole lot of suffering on the bottom, you know, if we don't do things to stop it. You know, as much over here in Europe as over there in the States and elsewhere, there's going to be a lot of evictions this year and all the rest. But again, at the level of image, at least for the time being, we're probably going to see, you know, good statistics that will allow Biden to present this image of having turned things around.
Well, we'll talk more about the pandemic in a bit, but I wanted to get your take on the storming of the Capitol and also all the talk that was leading up to it, including on It's Going Down, about a possible coup. And I'm just curious your thoughts on, you know, what does the storming of the Capitol say about the situation in the U.S. right now? And did people's predictions pan out in a certain way?
I have strong opinions on this. Like one thing that I've said is, you know, people are talking like, you know, how do we refer to this? Is it a coup? Is it a, you know, there's a lot of pushback against calling it an insurrection or a rebellion, because those are terms that we want, you know, that we hold dear and that we want to keep connected to uprisings against racism, against capitalism, things that we value, and to not sully those terms by allowing these right wingers to take it. And I think, you know, that we do have a good term for referring to pretty much exactly what happened on January 6th that puts it in its proper historical context. And that's a white riot. It was a racist assault by, a bunch of very entitled, violent people who wanted to, preserve like a certain racial and economic order that was most vociferously represented by Trump, even though in the long term, you know, Biden might do a more stable job of upholding that same order. I think it's really important not to fall into the right-wing fantasies. I'm sure many of them imagined that they were making a coup, but I think we need to have a much more intelligent analysis than they have about the complexity of power, all the different layers of power. I mean, 100 years ago, like a successful coup needed to seize at least 4 strategic points in the capital city, with like the seat of government, the radio station, train station, barracks or arsenal. That's already a simplification, but even then, they needed to be able to hold all those points in order to have like a serious shot at succeeding in a coup. And now governments are extremely more multi-layered. They're much more complex. Power is extremely more complexified. There would be, this is just totally like pulling it out of thin air, sort of approximation or simplification, at least 100, if not 1,000 nodes of power that people launching a coup would need to hold. And they didn't get any more than one. Like Trump hadn't even thought about a media strategy for making sure that, they could seize the media or even just maintain access to the media, because he clearly didn't, have any understanding with Facebook, with Twitter, with Fox News, with the infrastructures that he would need to continue broadcasting his propaganda, his version of the truth, his exhortations to his followers, because pretty immediately he got booted from all the social media. Fox broke with him. They weren't even able to completely seize the Capitol, despite the very weak police resistance. So I'm sure the guy with the buffalo horns thought that he was launching a coup, but I just want to emphasize that we need to have a more realistic analysis of how power works, because we need to stay clear-headed, because these dangers are so real. Across the world, we're facing very, very serious dangers. So we need to know the difference between like a riot in which, some people might get killed and like an actual, possible dictatorship taking power. We need an evidence-based approach. When there are plans for an actual coup, then, there's leaks, there's signs of military preparations, there are signs of different forms of coordination. And we saw none of that because there was none of that. The far right they're extremely violent, they're extremely dangerous, but they're also very, very poorly organized. And Trump also is not, he's not a courageous person at all. After just 2 hours, he was already telling people to go home. He was already walking it back. And, we saw at the inauguration that the far right was, for the most part, a no-show across the country. So they haven't had the organization to take the initiative. And it seems that they're, quite lost once their would-be leader has gone silent. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not a threat. They're definitely a threat. They're definitely dangerous, but they're dangerous on a different level. And so it's really important to identify what level they're dangerous at and what kind of dangers the state presents to us. The state, the government definitely presents a major danger, but it's going to be a different kind of danger, and it's going to come in democratic forms, which I imagine we'll talk about in a minute. And so finally, with the predictions, people were making different predictions. Some people were insisting that Trump would never leave office, that he was going to make a coup, that we're going to have a dictatorship. Other people were making more sober predictions about the kind of, physical and other dangers that folks would face. And finally, there's one thing that I want to emphasize. I'm not remembering the term right now, but there's a certain confirmation error where, like, for example, with the pandemic, if people take the appropriate precautionary measures, then the dangers of a pandemic won't manifest as much. And then there's the possible error that people will think, oh, I guess it wasn't that serious anyways. It was serious. It just didn't, its greatest danger didn't manifest because people did the right things. It's similar with fascists in the street. People like the anarchist movement in the U.S. definitely made the right call on recognizing the danger, on pushing this line of no platform for the far right, no platform for fascists. And so it's thanks to all of the amazing and courageous action of people who were in the streets, of the researchers who were doxing fascists, of people who were organizing legal support and medical support and all the rest. It's in large part thanks to them that the far right is so unorganized, so disorganized in the U.S. Because if people hadn't been drawing that line and fighting back really hard, then the far right would have been significantly more organized, and I think we might have seen more a more serious situation for example, on the 20th or on the 6th. So it's definitely not at all a question of saying that, you know, the far right didn't present a danger, but what kind of danger they presented. And that's certainly cause for celebration. I think, you know, celebrating all the comrades who did that very important and very brave work. But also, you know, people can live in like this state of panic only so long. It doesn't help us make good strategic decisions. I don't think it helped people thinking like, oh my God, there's about to be a coup when there really was no evidence of that. And so I think instead people can celebrate the fact that the far right is murderous. They're dangerous. You know, they're a danger to our, but they're relatively weak and disorganized thanks to very effective opposition. And so, you know, now people can pivot, to other dangers as well.
I do think it's interesting how fast people forgot about, for instance, like the Wildcat strikes in West Virginia that took over the state capitol there, or the Wisconsin protests, which took over the capitol for months, including, you know, many more thousands of people than were ever at the Trump rally. And, yeah, it's interesting just how quickly people, I feel like, bought into kind of the centrist media narrative that, you know, this was terrorism, you know, breaking a window to get into the building was terrorism. When, you know, union members, you know, have occupied and shut down Capitol buildings in various instances, like I just said, for much, much longer. And you know, yeah, they've received massive amounts of support. Of course, you know, the situation was completely different. But I think it's important to point that out, as people have said, it's not the fact that they, you know, stormed the Capitol that we should be condemning. The point is that these were, you know, white nationalist, fascist Trump supporters that were trying to do it in order to install Trump as the president for life, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, the Democrats won't be sad at all to see that. To see that weapon disappear from our arsenal, so to speak. Like, you know, Democrats are kind of in a sticky situation when unions are, you know, occupying a Capitol building, because they're supposed to be the party that represents the unions. So creating a political climate in which that's rebranded as terrorism is going to make it a lot easier for Democrats to avoid those kind of messy conflicts with the constituencies that they're historically, holding hostage. And again, like, you know, a capital occupation is not, you know, like you said, those are, you know, evacuated halls. It's not the most effective thing. But still, you know, in West Virginia and Wisconsin, those were important struggles. But, you know, then just imagine what they're going to say the next time people occupy airports, like that, you know, incredibly powerful wave of actions that happened in the very first month of Trump's presidency.
Although I will say, as somebody pointed out in a recent essay on It's Going Down, this was essentially the same logic as the so-called Brooks Brothers riot in 2000, where Roger Stone basically organized a whole group of Republican operatives to start a riot literally at a vote counting center and stop the vote. And then it forced it to go to the Supreme Court, and they, of course, gave it to George Bush in 2000. So, I mean, the logic was essentially the same, to disrupt, you know, quote-unquote, the democratic proceedings and to force some other body to make a decision. Hopefully that body was more aligned with President Trump.
Yeah. I mean, the Republican Party had their lawyers in place. Like, most indications going into November was that, especially when they backed off a bit from the post office strategy in August, I think, after that, most indications were that the Republicans were putting their preparation for, you know, winning, stealing the election in legal strategies, getting lawyers ready. And so I was actually surprised that they weren't more organized in doing exactly that kind of thing in the days immediately after the election. I mean, they tried in a few places, but it was not, you know, it wasn't as effective.
You know, as we've seen, there's a lot of anger on the far right. I mean, we'll see how palatable this is, but I would say it's fair to say that a lot of them feel betrayed by President Trump. Do they feel thrown under the bus?
Yeah, I don't think those people are just going to disappear and go into the dustbin of history. Different specific organizations will rise and fall, become more or less prominent. All of those white supremacists are definitely not going away. Yeah, I mean, it's a worry. There will almost certainly be more lethal attacks, like these kind of one-off attacks, you know, massacres, shootings, and stuff like that. To be honest, I think a lot of that was happening and that increased under the Obama administration was just a visceral reaction of a lot of these white supremacists to having a black president. So I think there will be a little bit less of that with Biden with a white president. But that's certainly one of the ways that some of those white supremacists are gonna go. And as for I really don't have a sensation right now how much like Trump, you know, a lot of Trump's brand was that he was a winner. He could get away with everything. And he very, very spectacularly did not get away with this last thing. And so that might be enough to kind of break the aura that he had. So I do not know if he or someone else will arise as the leader, or if he will continue, or if someone else will arise as the leader of the far right. But I've been thinking that is a very, very distinct possibility that actually you could have the Republican Party split. You could have the right, split between the part that, you know, that went along with Trump opportunistically because, you know, he had managed to get a lot of strength over the party, over the election process, like the prospects of election for people in the party, but who very much now want to put Trump behind them and get back to like a little bit more, you know, tried and true methods of doing politics. And then, you know, the dyed in the wool, completely convinced, far right, people who up till now have been Trump loyalists, but might follow another far right leader. The Republican Party will do everything it can to keep that from happening and to get, you know, traditional leadership, firmly in control of the party and the party's base. A lot of the base will be disappointed, so you'll probably have lower turnout for Republicans in future elections because of that. If the Republican Party splits, if some new party comes up, that's a danger because, again, you know, you're going to be able to have these completely openly unapologetically white supremacist, misogynist, far-right positions that are given legitimacy in the media that enter into the mainstream political discourse. So that's a danger. But on the other hand, since that just like takes what was already a minority, a small, under 50%, you know, being the right in the US and splits it roughly in half, it's going to mean almost certainly that Democrats would be winning most elections for a while. So that's something that people should look to. Will the Republican Party succeed in preventing that defection and getting control over its base, or will that third party emerge in some form?
In the real war, if it ain't justice we kill for, I ain't trying to hear y'all. If you ain't rhyme for Brianna or heed the call from Mario's mama, I'ma roll till they kill me. It is what it will be until they drop and all cops guilty. Ain't hearing what you hollering, your liberal consciousness. It's not defund, we talking abolishment, and politicians still duck when we riding through. It's fuck Trump, but it's also fuck Biden too. See, revolution is the answer. Reclaim your masters, all cops are bastards. Kill all fascists. We don't want to wonder when is it enough. Budgets a billion bucks plus just for killing us. If they cops, then it's fuck them. Your brother or your uncle or your dad or your cousin. There's no discussion. Fuck 12. I don't care if it's your daddy or your brother, nigga. Fuck 12. Family that suffered all the tragedies and casualties for nothing, motherfucker. Fuck
12. Also, I wanted to ask, you know, since the storming of the Capitol by the far right, there's been a lot of talk in centrists and other circles about pushing forward new domestic terror legislation. You know, we've already seen 20 years of this play out. You know, we don't need to rehash it. We saw everything under, you know, the first Biden administration with Obama, everything that's happened, everything from designating Black Lives Matter, Black Identity extremists, to, you know, a massive buildup of state powers like under the Patriot Act. So I'm just curious, you know, what do you think about all this talk about more domestic terror legislation?
It's definitely a danger. It's something people need to be paying attention to, need to be building opposition towards. And I think, you know, we've already seen a lot of good voices, good analyses, about, you know, coming not just from anarchists, but also from the left about how it's a danger. And it's definitely not a coincidence that this is coming and has a high chance of being effective from a Democratic administration, from a center-left administration. In general, historically, left-wing governments are actually more effective at conducting repression, especially against anarchists in particular. Right-wing governments usually have to go, you know, much more extreme, like, you know, go to full dictatorships, which you know, in themselves are quite destabilizing. They can be destabilizing towards, like, the normal functioning of capitalism, which doesn't mean, you know, obviously that capitalists will shy away from them, but you know, if they can deal with things in other ways, then they might tend to do that. So yeah, in general, left-wing governments are more effective at that kind of repression because, you know, they leave us more alone. Like, you know, we're more exposed when the group of people in opposition to the government is, you know, just revolutionary anti-capitalists. And also, you know, the right wing is certainly not going to be criticizing them at all for increasing the repressive powers of the state. Whereas the right wing does have to deal with some criticisms of, you know, opportunistic leftists in government and the center who, you know, criticize them for being more repressive. But what I most want to say is, people should be aware. People should, you know, talk about it, should find ways to protest it and oppose it. But we shouldn't get scared. Fear is systematically, it's one of the things that, that police forces count on. It's one of the most potent aspects of repression is making people afraid. There are a lot of really great texts out there analyzing the experiences from the Green Scare, from the grand jury resistance during the Obama administration. During the Green Scare, that repression was largely effective because of the ways the movement was more immature, less experienced, more isolated and exposed back in the aughts. And also, you know, looking at the people who were mostly targeted by the Green Scare, you know, becoming, you know, being active in the 90s, how they organized themselves in that even more isolated social context in the 90s. So that's what allowed the Green Scare to be so effective. And there's some really good analyses of what went wrong. And then on the other hand, the government was definitely trying to bring down possibly an even heavier repression against people who were participating in anti-police rebellions, other direct actions against banks, and so on and so forth, with various grand juries coast to coast. But people stayed really strong. It was a sign that the movement had learned its lessons, that people had gotten stronger, we had better structures, we were less isolated, and there was effective support. And so most of the grand juries failed in their repressive intentions. Another case from over here. Spain is one of the first countries to develop a very integral anti-terrorism politics. It has a very advanced anti-terror apparatus. I mean, it's you know, been systematically, like, arresting entire Basque villages and torturing generations of Basque youth to you know, try to stop the Basque independence struggle since the 70s and before. It was very much a continuation of the fascist Franco regime. At a certain point in the last decade, the Spanish state decided that the new number one enemy of the state was the anarchist movement. They brought that anti-terrorist apparatus to bear against anarchists here. We had dozens of arrests, but people didn't get afraid. There was a tremendous response, very importantly also from non-anarchists standing in solidarity with us. And the anti-terrorist campaigns failed to isolate us. And they fell apart. Eventually, the state largely walked back most of those most of those accusations. And it was exhausting. You know, it brought up, you know, bad dynamics. There were, you know, certainly things that wore down on the movement from that. But we didn't wind up, you know, with huge prison sentences, with, you know, our comrades and loved ones, you know, locked away for a really long time. And it made us stronger in the way of you know, seeing a huge segment of society stand up and say, we're also anarchists. We stand with the anarchists. So the repression can be defeated. It's really important, you know, not to get paranoid, not to get really afraid, but just to follow basic practices, to be conscious of, you know, what the strategies and what the different techniques of the government are, and to stand together to support one another.
So we're going to switch gears now again. And, you know, we brought up the anarchist movement, but let's talk about it specifically. And let's talk about what's been going on, in the U.S. since 2016. And I bet you would agree that there has been an uptick in anarchist activity, organizing, action, and also just visibility. And I'm just curious, you know, your thoughts on the movement as you see it, through the Trump era.
Yeah, I'm super impressed. Y'all have created so many amazing examples of struggle that have been, an inspiration around the world. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it was super common in other countries, you know, for people to be surprised that there were anarchists at all, or even any social movements in the U.S., in part because, you know, it's a global reputation as, you know, as like the world super cop and major capitalist power, but also because, you know, those social movements for a long time hadn't forced their way into the news. And, you know, comrades over there have developed, you know, anarchists and other anti-capitalists, other anti-racists all working together have developed very important tactics like the airport blockade, which is a very potent way to shut down the economy, to make, you know, a certain to really force the government to walk back a certain policy. The massive anti-racist rebellion so finishing that up about the airports, you know, that was a really potent symbol of solidarity with migrants. And that's really important because, questions of borders, of free movement, will become increasingly important around the world as various wars continue or escalate, as more and more people have to migrate or flee their homes because of desertification, because of climate change and things like that. So that's super important. There's the massive anti-racist, anti-police rebellion that started in the wake of the police murder of George Floyd. And that's spread to other countries around the world and also blended with similar ongoing movements in other countries around the world. And you know, of course, it was just, just really amazing in other countries to see, you know, police stations and courthouses and shopping malls, just, you know, all burning as people expressed their rage against this murderous police. It forced other countries, you know, also to have their own conversations about racism, about police violence. And that's really vital, you know, increasing these opportunities for international solidarity, for a more global consciousness. So I've personally been blown away. It's been really inspiring to learn from and to see the struggles that have really blossomed over there.
We now face a situation in which we are coming out of a rebellion and there's an amplification of repression. I believe, we just published an interview with, on It's Going Down, sort of about the legal context. And I think there's like over 300 people that are facing, charges across the United States, and there's supposedly many more, charges to come. And there's a lot of newly radicalized people. I mean, if you look at what happened on J20, you still had cities where, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people are taking to the streets. Specifically like very radical anarchist blocks. But we also have, I think the other context is that we have a large section of the population now, or a sizable section of the population, that has now switched from sort of becoming like active in opposition towards the Trump regime to now sort of a complacency, or at least wanting to see what will happen under Biden. Like, you know, what are they going to get out of it, basically? And I'm just curious, you know, what does this mean for the anarchist movement, where we kind of have this awkward point where sort of activity has kind of like fallen and repression is picking up, but yet we have a lot of people that are activated and radicalized. And I think they're kind of, you know, a lot of them are very new to this, and they're kind of looking for, okay, what do we do now? And I think for a lot of new people, the easiest thing is just to continue doing what you have been doing, even if that necessarily is not what's needed in that context. I'm just curious your thoughts on any of that.
Yeah, a couple things that I've seen in places where a left-wing government gets into power, left or even, you know, just center left like this one, and people, like you say, adopt this wait and see attitude, or, you know, get really enthusiastic at some point, and then face an inevitable disappointment. On the one hand, people who never bought in, you know, who don't expect anything out of Biden. One thing that's important is recognizing, you know, maybe there are fewer of us now. So you can't necessarily expect to keep up the same rhythm of activity. So I think it's really important to kind of roll with it and see, like, you know, not burn yourself out trying to do everything, but see, like, you know, what you can do, that recognize it is a very different atmosphere now. Another really big thing is, we know we're right. We know that the Biden administration is also going to be racist. It's also going to be capitalist. It's going to be terrible for a lot of people. But just because we can reasonably predict that a lot of people are going to get disappointed with the Biden administration doesn't mean that people are going to react to that with anger and by getting active again and by throwing down, by organizing things, by resisting. A lot of times what really happens is that people just go through this like psychological withdrawal. It's just like too much for after, you know, so many years of like this just openly, very exaggeratedly horrible right-wing government, that you think, you know, things might get better, and you see a lot of the same things change. People kind of stick their heads in the sand. They get depressed. They give up. So I think folks should be ready for that. Folks shouldn't just expect, you know, all of, you know, these disillusioned, you know, progressives and semi-radicals to, you know, just come, you know, charging back to the revolution. If folks don't find intelligent ways of articulating the struggle in these years, a lot of those folks are just going to burn out and give up. So I think a lot of it comes down to identifying fault lines of social conflict and struggle that remain every bit as valid and lucid or cogent, I guess, now as before. And things that, you know, off the top of my head, things that come to mind are eviction defense. You know, that's I think going to be very important, and it's, you know, certainly hard to argue against. It's something that very much explains itself. Continued resistance and fighting back to police murders, to police racism and violence, because we know that that's not going away. And very recently that, you know, has won a great deal of legitimacy from, you know, a huge part of the population, like the huge number of people who said that it was totally valid to burn down the police station in Minneapolis, people who started, you know, sympathizing with looting or directly participating. And that's also important because that's an issue in which the Democrats and the Republicans are almost in the exact same place. Of course, the Democrats will have a lot of allies who will be in the streets, who will voice sympathy with the rioters, but then, you know, try to bring them back to the flock. But the Democrats themselves, you know, are not going to be able to express, you know, those thoughts to quite that extent, especially when they're the ones in power, right? And so that, you know, that's something that we want. We want people to see, you know, where the Democrats and the Republicans are in the same camp. Self-organizing by migrants and solidarity with migrants against immigrant detention centers, against the border, indigenous struggles against pipelines. Those are things that, that, you know, they're not going away. The people who don't sympathize with those struggles, you know, we don't want them on our side anyways. And it's where also where I think folks can make a difference and do important work. And they're all things that either are going to be staying the same or getting worse. Like with, you know, some kind of Green New Deal, or at least like, you know, an increase in government funding for environmental initiatives, a lot of that means land grabs. A lot of that means, you know, painting oil pipelines green. A lot of that means, you know, seizing farmland for huge wind farms or solar farms. The green transition is going to be terrible for the land. It's going to be terrible for a lot of people who live on the land. And that's, you know, that's something, you know, that's a place we need to be.
You know, I do want to ask you another question on the coronavirus, though. You know, you said something on this program before that I thought was really, really spot on. You said that the ruling class made a decision across the board that the exploited and the excluded, and this in terms of, like, you know, consensus on policy, not that they all got together in one room or something, that the, you know, the working class, the poor, the exploited would pay for the pandemic resulting in the current crisis we have in now. And, you know, we read a recent report that really hit me, where U.S. GDP is now 5% below what it was when the pandemic began. And I'm just curious, you know, what does this tell us about capitalism and the state in 2021, that 400,000 people are dead, people are in lockdown conditions, and yet production is only 5% below what it was in February of 2020.
I mean, first of all, a 5% drop in GDP is actually a pretty major recession. But again, you know, if you look at it in more human terms, you know, that is pretty astounding. And another thing that's important to keep in mind to put that figure in perspective is that, would put my hand in the fire, and you know, I did, and you know, many other, like, not just me, obviously, many anti-capitalists, the Black Rose Federation, you know, many people were publishing things saying that another recession is inevitable. And so, you know, if you were looking at the signs in 2019, a recession was going to happen anyways, right around, you know, early 2020. So even without the pandemic, a part of that economic decline would have happened. What it tells us, I mean, we can look at what the capitalists were saying themselves very, very explicitly. Like in the UK, some of them were even, you know, caught on record, and also some, you know, some state level politicians in the US saying that, the value of the human life lost to the pandemic would be less than, the value of the economic losses associated with shutting down the economy to try to stop the pandemic. And when they're talking about value, when they're saying that we should let people die, because we'll lose more money if we shut down the economy, which they were saying very literally and caught on record saying that, they're actually talking about value in a very, very exact, scientific measured sense, because I mean, there's basically an entire industry. There's, you know, major branches of the insurance industry and of other industries that exist to calculate the value of a human life. How old are you? Where you live? What's your education? And for each of us, they have a dollar value of, okay, how much more value can we produce for the economy before we die? So therefore, an older person has less value, so it's less of a loss if we just let them die. A person who is, you know, less educated or is working in a field where their value is not, or where their labor is not valued as much, they're worth less to the economy, and the economy doesn't lose out on as much if we just let them die. So they're completely pathological. They capitalists have absolutely the thinking of mass murderers. And I'm not just, you know, saying that, tangentially, and it's certainly not an exaggeration. There are people whose job it is to calculate the monetary value of each of us so that capitalists, bank managers, investment fund managers, politicians, insurance executives, and all the rest can decide whether it's worth their while or not to let us live. Like, you know, these are the people who own the world. We've seen that in, you know, throughout Europe, throughout the US, in Brazil, how, you know, they were just very happy to let us die. And before that, they were very happy to privatize healthcare, to, you know, gut and, you know, any kind of public health care and all the rest. And that has real consequences. And, you know, one of them is, you know, 400,000 people dead in the US, more than 2 million around the world. So, yeah, that's how capitalists think.
It seems in mainstream politics, we're going to continue to see this playing off of a notion of a culture war, and especially this supposed, you know, city versus rural divide. And of course, there's a lot of class and racial implications in these, you know, kind of fantasies about how the world is divided. But I'm just curious if you have any insight on how anarchists or autonomous anti-capitalist movements might sidestep this kind of way of viewing the world and make connections with people across those paradigms.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, not believing in it, reminding ourselves and reminding everyone else that a huge number of Trump supporters were, you know, wealthy people. A lot of the people who went to the Capitol on January 6th were business owners. They, you know, went there in private jets. And also, for one thing, you know, breaking this association of rural people with white people, you know, remembering that, you know, how there have been and continue to be a lot of really powerful indigenous struggles in on the land, defending the land, defending the water, fighting against pipelines, fighting against coal mines. That also, you know, there's been, you know, throughout the 20th century and continuing to the present, there's been, especially in the South, a huge conflict and an attempt to dispossess black farmers, to dispossess black people of the land. And you know, like I mentioned before, there's a lot of struggles that can take place in rural areas as capitalism expands, especially with this green energy transition, which is taking off across the world. And that's going to directly affect the ability of a lot of people to have, you know, some kind of access to the land. And that's a fight that a lot of anarchists have been supporting, resisting those land grabs and also supporting indigenous sovereignty, supporting indigenous struggles. And that's something that, you know, that needs to continue. It would also be interesting to see more projects, more initiatives that create horizontal links between collectives in the city and collectives in the countryside. That, you know, might be a bit more long term, but it would certainly be interesting to see, you know, projects of people feeding themselves, also giving opportunities to people in urban environments to go out to the countryside. Because when you're doing agricultural work at a more human scale, the intensity of the work is not at all flat or continuous. And so, you know, people who have rural projects can definitely benefit from having sort of like a sister collective in the city where a bunch of people come out, you know, on certain days of the year to help with the harvest, help with the planting or something like that. And then you turn it into a festival, turn it into a party. Because, I mean, you know, if you're working in the city or you work a desk job, it's extremely enjoyable to engage in this kind of physical labor, getting your hands dirty. And you know, it's healthy to make that, you know, to have that kind of balance. And, you know, then you can, you know, have a party and, you know, do that sort of thing. And then folks in, you know, the rural collective can help get, you know, healthy, real food, get to folks in poor neighborhoods in the city. It's a bit of a dream, but, you know, it's one that I think wouldn't hurt for people to dream. There's more things like that, I think, over here. Also in large part because it's a bit easier because cities don't sprawl quite as much. So the distance between city and countryside isn't as far. I think it would be definitely useful to break some of this isolation of the countryside, which is very much, by the way, an objective of counterinsurgency social engineering for the state. Like throughout the second half of the 20th century, the state was making it a high priority, understanding peasant societies, understanding rural space, and restructuring rural space to empty it of people, to isolate it. To rationalize it and all the rest. So, you know, it wouldn't hurt to have more fronts there and to have more connections that break that divide between the city and the countryside.
I'm just curious, you know, you have an interesting vantage point, cause you have connections, in different places, but I'm just curious, you know, based on what you're seeing happening in other countries and other places, what things are you seeing in, other geographies that different social movements, anarchists are engaging in that people in the U.S. can really learn from?
There have been really, really powerful and interesting struggles across the world over these past years, obviously. But I mean, I was thinking about this question in advance, and I think much more interesting than you know, whatever things, whatever struggles I could mention or whatever innovations I could mention in 5 minutes would be to talk about a certain methodology about how to create those bridges. One weakness that, you know, it's a generalization, but I think it holds true a lot of the time for a lot of the movements in the U.S. Has to do with internationalism or a possible lack of internationalism, like, you know, being in, you know, the sort of imperial core, you know, it's easy to not, look at the rest of the world. It's easy to just be focused on the U.S. reality. But I think we really need to have a global consciousness. We need international relationships of solidarity in order to be strong. And also because revolutions don't work in one country, you know, revolutions need to be international. And a major part of that, and I think also, you know, a responsibility of folks in the U.S., at least, you know, people born in the U.S. with the privilege of citizenship, I think there's a responsibility to learn other languages. It's hard to talk about internationalism if, you know, if you can only speak one language, and what's more, you know, it's like the kind of globally dominant, language because of capitalism, basically. So I think one thing, and, you know, everyone's got a lot on their plate, but one thing that, you know, folks can find time for, it would be especially to create relationships of solidarity with specific groups and movements, especially in Latin America, if you're living in the States. For listeners in the UK, you know, then maybe other, I mean, you know, people can decide, you know, where it makes most sense to have those. But there's, I mean, I think there's a need also for learning from struggles in countries in the global South, to find ways to materially support those struggles, you know, to create these relationships of solidaristic internationalism. So I think if people, you know, set themselves these projects of learning other languages, making contacts with comrades in other countries, and creating, you know, this sort of, partnership, these sort of relationships of solidarity, then people are going to learn a whole lot more than you know, if I spent 2 hours, you know, rabbiting on about, you know, different innovations in different countries. But, you know, I will really emphasize that, because the times that I've learned most in my life, not just about, you know, whatever place I'm in, but also about where I come from, about the U.S., has been, you know, when I'm going to other countries, meeting comrades from other places, because, you know, you can put things in perspective that way. And that's, you know, really how I've learned the most. And so I'd very strongly encourage anarchists in the U.S. to, and not in an individualistic way, but like as, I mean, we don't really have communities in the U.S. for the most part, but, you know, we would like to. So in those kind of proto communities, in those collectives, to make a collective decision to pool our resources. Okay, who has time right now to learn another language? Well, let's support them. You know, let's help them buy their plane ticket. Who has the contacts so that they can, you know, go spend a few months in this place and, you know, make real connections, and you know, not just go to like anthropologists to like leech off of them, but, you know, also, you know, what can we offer? What forms of support can we offer? You know, for their own struggles. And, you know, just because the best solidarity is based in real meaningful relationships. And so to collectivize those relationships, to build them up. And that, I think, is going to help people a lot to get more perspective and also make our struggles more global, which they really need to be.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. If you appreciate It's Going Down and want us to grow into 2021, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. And sign up to donate monthly or give us a one-time donation. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop. Thanks a lot for listening. Thanks for supporting us. Let's get back to the show. Well, one other quick question I wanted to ask you, and I was watching a video from the New York Times opinion section, and they made this video, and it was talking about QAnon, and it started off as pretty much just like a generic kind of like, here's what QAnon is. But about two-thirds into it, they start comparing QAnon to other conspiracy theories, and they do this as a way to basically say, like, well, you wouldn't believe this, would you? And they talk about, like, the JFK assassination. And then at one point they say, like, lots of people believe in anarchism. And then they show this photo of Noam Chomsky, which is ironic because, from my understanding, Chomsky is a regular contributor to the New York Times. But they show this photo of Chomsky, and then they show a photo of something from the Seattle so-called autonomous zone that was there for a couple weeks. And they say, like, you know, lots of people believe in anarchism, but anarchism has never worked. It's imploded every time it's been implemented. And I know that, you know, you've wrote a whole book about anarchists and experiments and revolutions and autonomous forms of life. I'm just curious, how would you respond to that assertion that anarchism has, quote, imploded every time it's been implemented?
I mean, the New York Times making any claim to speaking of facts is just laughable. They're the newspaper that gave us the 2003 invasion of Iraq on the grounds of weapons of mass destruction that everybody knew at the time were false. So I mean, they're absolute hypocrites. And I would add that it's not a coincidence that, you know, on CNN and, you know, different politicians, different commentators on January 6th were saying, you know, these are anarchists, referring to the white supremacist rioters. And it's not a coincidence that the New York Times now is, you know, comparing us to a conspiracy theory. They're setting their sights on anarchists. They recognize the anarchist movement as a big threat, a big possible disruptor to this, you know, democratic narrative of unification and social justice going forward. So that's, you know, they're doing that very cynically, they're very aware of what they're doing. And so that, you know, they're giving us a warning, you know, when someone gives you a warning that they're, you know, about to punch you in the face, you know, be wise to prepare. It's, you know, it has no historical basis. It's laughable. There are many examples of explicitly anarchist revolutions, anarchist societies in practice in the Mexican Revolution, during the Spanish Civil War, during the Russian Civil War in Ukraine, in Rangulya-Ipolia, in the Shinmin province of Manchuria, organized by the Korean Anarchist Communist Federation. In the Balkans, during the Stranja commune, and some of these involved millions of people. Some of these lasted for up to 2 years. That's a big question. Why did they not last longer than 2 years? In the majority of cases, it was actually because of, you know, being stabbed in the back by supposed allies. Being attacked by the Red Army, which, you know, was drawing off a population hundreds of times larger than what you had in the liberated area of Ukraine during the Russian Civil War. In every case, it was ended by repression. They never imploded. They didn't implode. They were destroyed by imperial armies. They were destroyed by communist armies, often by, you know, being attacked by both at the same time. So it's completely disingenuous, you know, for people who fashion themselves to be progressives to claim, you know, that it didn't work, when they were among those who made sure that we weren't ever given a chance to organize ourselves, to live in freedom, that they would massacre, they would slaughter however many people it took to destroy those dreams of freedom and those very real and effective practices of freedom. And I might also add, that also doesn't mean that anarchy is defenseless, right? Like in the Mexican Revolution, a little bit less so, but definitely the Korean Anarchist Communist Federation in Shinmin province, the Makhnovshchina in Ukraine, also in the Spanish Civil War, voluntary anarchist fighting units, pound for pound, were more effective and sometimes extremely more effective than anyone else in the field. The only problem was, you know, these were coming from, you know, kind of like a more minority place where, you know, it was a much smaller territory. It was a much smaller group that was organizing in an anarchist way. So we were, you know, again and again, outnumbered 1,000 to 1 and outgunned on an even greater scale because, I mean, the anarchist fighters in Ukraine, the only weapons they had were the weapons that they were able to steal from their enemies. So, and you know, the fact that they, you know, won these crucial battles without which the Red Army actually would have been defeated by the White Army says a lot. Aside from, you know, early 20th century history, there's the fact that the vast majority of human history has been anarchic. If humans needed governments to survive, we would not exist currently as a species because most of our history has been anarchic, has been without states, and states for the most part have not been a voluntary choice. You know, people haven't adopted states because, oh, hey, look, that's more effective. They actually come with lower life expectancies, more disease, more, you know, more wars, more violent wars. More poverty and starvation. The world is subject to state authority now because it was conquered. It was conquered at a very specific moment when, you know, we don't have time to get into now, but, you know, there's been a whole lot written about this, where, you know, Europe found itself in a position where it had a lot of really, really major technological advantages. So that, in a nutshell, is why the state is a global structure. It's not because it works better. In fact, the state and capitalism have now brought us to the edge of the abyss. You know, they're the first social system in human history that is giving us, you know, the wonderful possibility of total annihilation, of extinction. And, you know, that's just the fact that they're still out there pretending that, you know, they're promoting something that works is just ludicrous. But, you know, I mean, anyone who takes the New York Times too seriously or takes them as, you know, some harbinger of truth, I think has forgotten a couple things. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, anything else you want to say or talk about or plug right now?
Actually, yeah. Let me plug a book that's just coming out. It's a book that that I translated that I didn't write. It was edited and coordinated by Ricardo Vargas Golorons, originally in Catalan, just coming out with AK Press in English, the translation I did. It's about Salvador Puig Antic and the Mil and the Olla. These were different armed groups that were struggling in the final years of the Franco dictatorship, the fascist dictatorship in Spain in the 70s, at a time when you had a growing wave of wildcat strikes, really huge, hundreds of thousands of workers, you know, with their creating their own assemblies, launching wildcat strikes, really one of the factors that forced the fall of the fascist regime. And these were people in these armed groups who were doing bank expropriations, getting money for clandestine literature, illegal literature, for, you know, these study groups that the workers were organizing in order to be able to, you know, kind of identify more effective strategies to educate themselves. Also, you know, expropriating banks, getting money for strike funds, for, you know, to support families of those who were arrested, those who were killed. So basically a way to use stronger and also direct action tactics to support this large anti-capitalist struggle to make it stronger. And so I think it's something that's definitely relevant for today. It's not just ancient history. It gets into a lot about how, you know, what people learned from struggles in a different era about the relationship between fascism and democracy, ways to support anti-capitalist struggles, and all the rest. And so, yeah, so encourage people to check that out on Salvador Puig Antic on AK Press.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.